It's the Wonky Show. We've got some future visions to look at, demand for HE to guesstimate, some big generational shifts, and some new funding for the sector in Wales. It's all coming up.
The story that Lewis Elton, kind of one of the first professors of higher education in the UK, used to tell, it goes back to the days of Oxford, where there was a student practicing archery in the street and killed a local person. And there was a big debate about whether the student should be dealt with by the university or by the local police.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Jim Dickinson, still self-isolating up here in the attic, but here to make sense of everything going on. As usual, we have two fabulous guests. In Lancaster, Paul Ashwin is Professor of Higher Education at Lancaster University and Deputy Director of the Centre for Global Higher Education. Paul, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is a little self-centred, but I got sent a blog from Michael O'Neill, an early career inorganic chemistry lecturer, who's been reflecting on what my recent book, Transforming University Education Manifesto, says to him about the point of teaching undergraduates. And it's just really nice. The book was written in order to inspire that kind of debate and reflection. And it's just so lovely to see that.
Fantastic. And good plug for the book there. It's a great read. The link to details to where you can buy it will be in the show notes. It's available from all good bookstores and Amazon as well. And in York, Marion Hilditch is Deputy Academic Registrar at the University of Bradford and Chair of SHROC. Marion, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is that this Wednesday, it was International Pronouns Day. And although pronouns are nothing new, there seemed to be a bit more positive buzz around it this year, which was really encouraging to see, and big organisations like the NHS promoting it. So it's just felt, it's been a really feel-good kind of like week for trans inclusion.
Great stuff. So yes, we start this week with the future. Universities UK has been doing some polling and has published a vision, and there's a new report out on Scotland's tertiary system. Paul, what's going on?
Well, this I think can be seen as a kind of shift towards the tertiary moment. As you mentioned, you've got the Scottish Funding Council review of higher and further education that's kind of moving towards tertiary. You know, in anticipation of the Augar review, tertiary is also kind of part of this UK vision for universities. And this is kind of slightly trailing in the wake of what Wales did in 2016 with the Hazelcorn review, and their at the moment consulting about, you know, what tertiary looks like in Wales. And I think, you know, whilst the kind of shift to tertiary is potentially incredibly exciting, having a far more open system and relationship between further and higher education in which students can move easily, there's kind of three things that I think you have to think about when deciding whether that's going to be effective or not. The first is, what are the drivers for tertiary education? Is it really a way of saving money, or actually is it about a commitment to social justice and ensuring that as many students as possible have access to high quality education? It's also the question of whose perspective does the tertiary system look like a tertiary system. So when I look at the proposals in Wales, you know, from a institutional organisational perspective, it's a single tertiary kind of funding council, but actually there's still a separation of FE and HE. So really, from a student's perspective, I'm not quite sure how tertiary that would look. And then the final challenge with tertiary is that clearly having free movement between different sectors of education is really important and can really aid social mobility. But what does that mean for educational programmes? If education becomes a series of modules that you take with you, the kind of education that's actually focused on a programme that changes students over time becomes more challenging. So that's another kind of, you know, difficult tension to think about in relation to tertiary education.
Yeah, this programme stuff is interesting. Marion, the Universities UK the other day launched, when it did launched the vision, launched this piece of polling, and their headline was "Huge Demand for Bite-Sized Learning Revolution." Do you get a sense there's lots of demand for sort of, you know, students to come and get an individual student loan for an individual module? Or, you know, is Paul right that we need to be encouraging people onto kind of more life-changing programmes? Where's the balance?
I'll be honest, I don't think I have seen this overwhelming demand for bite-sized learning. A review of the student funding would definitely be welcome, as it is quite rigid right now. And that would certainly be a positive thing. But yes, there is a balance. And I think what we've seen is themselves, I think many people were quite skeptical about it, is how well apprenticeships have actually been used and received as a model of sort of this blended staying in full-time work, but also at the same time developing your learning. And I think there's definitely more room. There is an appetite, but what form that takes is perhaps, as you say, there is a balance between a full-scale degree and bite-sized learning, or accumulative credit, or having the opportunity to, you know, start learning, give it up, and then come back and make use of what you've done in the past.
Now, Paul, who knows where the Augar review response will end up? But I mean, I think we were expecting some kind of response to Augar to come out in this FE white paper. But then over the past 48 hours, it's kind of emerged that there won't be a comprehensive spending review. And without a CSR, it's quite hard to imagine that major proposals will be sort of launchable, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very difficult to see how a number of things in relation to higher education policy with the Augar review and also with the long-awaited Pearce review of the TAF, you know, we're kind of in a situation of kind of waiting whilst universities are under incredible financial pressure. I mean, you know, it's kind of striking with the UUK document, how it's titled very boldly as a vision for universities. But when you actually read it, it's a list of things the government needs to do. It feels kind of a strange thing for Universities UK to be doing at the moment is very much foregrounding what they want government to do rather than foregrounding what they can do and what universities can do. And clearly it's completely understandable given the kind of financial precarity of the sector. But as a tactical move, I'm not sure it's the smartest one.
Marion, I was having a conversation with someone the other day that went along the lines of lots of this kind of, you know, looking to the future, vision stuff and so on. It's actually genuinely difficult when we are still as a sector in the middle of handling a pandemic. You know, I don't detect a lot of, and I don't think this is anyone's fault, but I don't detect a lot of kind of big vision stuff going on inside universities. People are just kind of coping, aren't they, at this point?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I do have to agree with what Paul was saying. The UK report did read very much. First of all, it read like something that is happening in the world without a pandemic. And then it also read like something that was very much of the offensive. So it was just trying to damage control. A damage limitation rather than a vision of the future, which the Scottish report actually, I think, does a bit better in that sense. But you're absolutely right, Jim, in that the sector is certainly not in any place right now to think ahead. We've had a very rough, it's been 7 months now, where we were just trying to make do and trying to keep everything afloat. And I believe the sector has done an exceptionally good job of that. But I don't think anyone is in a place right now to be creative about what's to come. But at the same time, I want to say that I think it would be a missed opportunity if we do not look at what we have achieved over the past 7 months and try to build on it. Our digital literacy as a sector has certainly gone up. And I think we have to make use of that and build on that for the future and perhaps start to reconsider some of the traditional teaching methods that we have always taken for granted and see whether there is anything that positive that can actually come out of all the things we've learned.
Paul, you were saying that, you know, obviously in Wales, to some extent, we've got this kind of superstructural change in terms of funding councils, but actually below that, we're still going to have FE and HE. What's your impression of where the Scotland document might kind of take the tertiary sector to north of the border?
Well, at the moment, the Scottish report seems much more ambitious and fundamentally much more radical, but it's at a much earlier stage. And my reading these kind of initiatives is that they start off bold. You know, when you read, you know, I was looking the other day again at the Hazelcorn Review, that's bold and radical. And then the way in which that's been then institutionalised, you know, for very good reasons, then becomes more like a kind of reorganisations of kind of policy bodies. So you know, the big question is how do you get the different sectors together? And in a way, the UUK report kind of gives a nice view of that, because clearly it engages with tertiary, you know, anticipating the Augar review, but it's very much a tertiary version that's kind of shaped and dominated by universities, you know, in my reading of it. And I think that's the, you know, that's a big challenge. How do you get these different institutions together with different institutions with different interests and actually create a system that works from the student's perspective. That is really, really tricky. And when you're starting out, or in the earlier stages, as the Scottish Review is, it's easier to be radical once you engage with the kind of different interests and the need for each institution to be sustainable, then that becomes much more difficult.
Great. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Robert Perry. I'm the head of research at consultancy Pickle Jar Communications. This week on Wonky, I've blogged about students and their perceptions of the value of university during the COVID-19 pandemic. I spend a lot of time talking to students about their experiences, and in my piece, I reflect on the current growing demand for fee refunds due to what they see as a diminished service this year. This can turn into a very impassioned debate because those of us in the sector know how much hard work has been going on behind the scenes to provide online teaching and remote access to services, all that kind of thing. But students don't really see any of that. They don't see any of the extra work that's going in. They just know that they haven't been getting what they believe they've paid for. So I explore some of that disparity in perceptions, and I argue that the sector now needs to address how it talks about value, how it makes that case to disgruntled students or students in the future.
Hi, I'm Ria Bluck, and I work as a research practitioner at the University of Nottingham Students' Union. Our most recent piece of research, called I Just Feel Really Misunderstood, is a qualitative exploration into EDI and marginalised students' experience. And we did this by exploring themes of discrimination, representation and well-being. We soon saw how different types of engagement through student groups can help develop a sense of belonging and how intra-minority discrimination can threaten that. To ensure belonging, it's important to build an understanding between students who don't share protected characteristics as well as represent marginalised groups more generally. If anything, this research acts as a call to others in higher education to conduct similar institution-specific research and to take the necessary steps to understand their own marginalised student communities.
Now, next up, more future-gazing. HEPI has updated its predictions on demand for HE into the future and has reached some startling conclusions. Marion, explain.
This is the brand new HEPI report that came out on Thursday morning about demand to higher education to 2035. This is an update to the earlier report by HEPI, which came out in 2018, which was demand in higher education was 2030. It's reached some sort of predictable and perhaps conclusions, such as there will be a high demand. However, it isn't quite as much as they had predicted 2 years ago, because we are seeing a decline in the number of 18-year-olds post 2030. It's also making a lot of assumptions about perhaps policy around recruitment and the demand itself remaining constant throughout this period. But effectively, the conclusion is that we're going to need many more universities' worth of places in order to cope with it in England, whilst in Scotland and Northern Ireland, we're seeing a little bit more of an evening out of demand versus number of 18-year-olds.
Paul, it's fascinating, isn't it? There's people use graphs from HEPI's publications on this, and then sometimes they use data HE's, and there's a kind of rivalry about the two sets of projections. But either way, both point to this significant growth in demand because of population. How can it be met? Can it be met?
The question is, the processes by which it's met. So kind of how is it met in terms of the detail? And my reading of the HEPI report is that this isn't really telling us what the future demand will look like. It's preparing us to think about the shape of higher education in the future and how we begin to maneuver it so that it can meet that demand. And again, we're waiting for so many. I'm kind of sorry to repeat things from earlier, but waiting for the Augur review, outcomes and response, and as you said, the delay to the spending review. So much is uncertain. This kind of adds to the weight of the need to do something. But until those structures are clearer, my sense is the demand will be met, because we've never had that moment really where you know, it hasn't been, but how it's met is kind of dependent on things that we're kind of still waiting to see the shape of.
Marion, in some ways, the story of the last, you know, 6 to 8 weeks has been a story, at least in the press, about traditional residential higher education, people in the boarding school model leaving home, going somewhere else to read a subject and being packed into halls of residence and then spreading a virus. is it sustainable to meet the sort of demand that Heppy talks about here through more kind of boarding school HE, or do we have to start to get really clever about other types of, you know, ways to meet the demand?
Well, yes. I mean, I work for a university that does not follow this model. So we do not have student accommodation. We do have a large percentage of students living at home. And so this national conversation over the past few weeks has felt a little bit alien in a way. I don't think that, you know, even if you take it at face value, the demand for HE will, you know, keep the current trajectory. I don't think that that necessarily means that it will keep that, the demand will be for that traditional model. And that, coupled with the conversation we've just been having about types of education and different educational models, there's certainly a lot more space for more online learning. The space for, you know, I don't know if we're still talking about 2-year degrees or not right now. It's hard to keep track, but there are different types of learning. And this, I think, there are absolute benefits to the model. I really dislike the boarding school terminology, but there are benefits to the sort of traditional university model. Both, you know, beyond education and, you know, allowing young people to leave home and, you know, become part of a different community, that is the benefit in itself that we can't overlook, really. So there is room for different models here, and there is absolutely no need why what we need to be focusing on is more traditional style universities.
Paul, let's say there's loads more local, loads more kind of bite-sized stuff, loads more 2-year degrees, and then there are still a whole bunch of universities that are kind of fairly remote academic theme parks on the edge of a town or city like where you work. Are we doomed forever to view, you know, that sort of traditional HE as the most elite, you know, as the thing to aspire to? Or could we get somewhere, do you think, where, you know, the kind of mixture of different types of HE might be regarded, you know, more sort of equally, I guess?
It certainly feels like we're doomed to do that. I mean, you know, varieties of education and varieties of pathways are incredibly important. But you know, when they're for other people or other people's children, then you've got a real problem. And I think, you know, certainly, you know, online education for part-time students who have a rich kind of environment in which to take their learning outside of the university context works really well. I think, you know, there's a real educational challenge in having full-time online programs that give the kind of rich experience that you'd have in a campus, you know, either in a campus or a city-based university, but where you're going and you're mixing with other people and there's experiences outside of the, you know, kind of core curriculum that help you to develop and think about what you're doing at whatever age. So you know, that for me is one of the challenges of, you know, people talking about the shift to online. It's difficult to know what would be a rich educational environment if you're studying full time online. That's something that I struggle to see. But yeah, I think, you know, particularly given the model that's developed in England and the kind of way in which prestige and quality are wrongly but very strongly connected to each other in people's perceptions, you know, it's very hard to see how you can get away from the idea that the elite is higher quality, even though there's plenty of evidence that those two things don't necessarily always go together.
Now, Science Minister Amanda Soloway made a speech this week and DK was listening.
So Tuesday saw Heppy host Science Minister Amanda Soloway, who had been heavily trailed with announcing a review of the Research Excellence Framework. It's fair to say things didn't quite play out that way. She did admittedly confirm that she had written to Research England to start working on a plan to reform the REF with devolved counterparts, as indeed is customary at the end of each cycle. What we didn't really get was a sense of what this review might entail. Soloway spent a long time on what I like to call the ref myths, old chestnuts like how reputable research can only be an article or monograph, how journal impact and citation counts are distorting the publication process, and ref is somehow to blame for this. I need hardly add that, although each myth contains a kernel of accreated truth linked to the way some less experienced providers interpret ref rules, each has been slain time and time again in the published guidance to ref. Opinion is divided on the speech. I heard uncanny echoes of the letters page of the Times Higher Education Supplement in the early noughties. Others saw a threat to the very idea of research assessment. But this was alongside the hugely welcome nod to the Forum for Responsible Metrics and parallel international initiatives to stop people measuring research in silly ways. And to be absolutely clear, Soloway committed to protect the dual support system. It was not the speech that was advertised, but there was much to welcome in a closer look at research culture. But what this has to do with the ref, along with conclusions reached by the Stern review that lie waiting to be implemented, is unclear.
Hi, it's Debbie from Team Wonky, here to tell you that on the 4th of November we'll be hosting an event, bringing the sector together to talk about student retention at Don't Drop Out, Averting a Student Retention Crisis. We'll release new research into how students are feeling and hear from students' unions about what's going on the ground. We'll think through the challenges for universities of keeping students on course, helping them socialise safely and maintain their wellbeing during all the disruptions they're experiencing due to COVID-19. And we'll ask about the national policy implications of a potential student retention crisis. As the government frets about how to bring students home for Christmas, should we really be thinking about what happens in January? Do we need to create an exit strategy for students and a safety net for universities? That's Don't Drop Out on the 4th of November. To find out more and book your tickets, go to wonky.com/events.
Now, every week on the podcast, we're delving deep into the sector's past to uncover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's academic registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
Expanding our universities is one of those things that has been an issue all the way through the history. How do we deal with that? How do we deal with the fact that there comes a point where government needs to expand our universities and think about how it wants to organise that? Now, less so in a market type system, but when we had planning bodies, how should we do that? Now, the biggest set of expansion came straight after the Second World War, where they knew in advance that returning students were going to come back, either the already gone off to war, they've been off into a variety of different occupations, and they were going to want to have higher education. The Americans handled this through their GI Bill, but we set about just expanding our universities. And the interesting bit is that we started planning for this in active way in 1943. So before we've even invaded Normandy, the British university sector is planning to have won the war and how it's going to cope with all the students who are going to come back. So excellent planning from the UGC. And off it goes. It works out that actually it doesn't really need to expand the number of universities, because most of the universities it's been funding have been really small all the way through the 30s. Again, if we think we have trouble now, try running a university through the Great Depression when most of the students have to pay their fees. So they've not expanded as much as they thought, so they were ready for them all to expand. The only difference is that the chair of the UGC, Walter Mobley, is persuaded to let the University College of North Staffordshire start. And so A.D. Lindsay persuades him that it would be a really good idea to set up a new kind of university. And Mobley is very concerned about how the war has gone, how it's impacted on universities, and he thinks we need new types of students. And so they're allowed to run a four-year course, predominantly residential, an opportunity to have a foundation course at the minute. So it's trying to do something different. And they get going, and everyone else starts to expand. And then we go through the 50s, just slowly upgrading universities. So the university colleges become universities, they all expand. There's a bit of a backlash if you think about Kingsley Amis and Lucky Jim and his more means worse thing. But generally, this is the idea that we can continue. By the end of the decade, it's clear we need more universities. They accede to a bid from Sussex to set up a new university college at Brighton. But then, having got to that stage, they have a pause and think it's probably worth having a think about setting up new types of universities. And then starts this marvellous thing, this bidding competition to have universities. So the bidding competition to have new universities is an excellent and really exciting example of how British university planning worked. They set up a subcommittee. Great and the good come on the subcommittee. They happily sit together, work out what they should do. Now, people have been writing in saying, hello, can I have a university for a while now? So they've got a file already of towns and cities that said, can we have a university, please? So they're ready to go. So they've got a group of people they can contact and say, are you still interested in having a university? And they work out what the criteria are for having a good university. It needs plenty of land in order to expand. It needs to have good access to schools so that staff will come and let their kids go to those schools. It needs to have a certain amount of industry nearby and communications to other universities. But there's no kind of fixed idea of what they should do. They also don't have a fixed idea of where they should be, so they just let the applications come in and then sort them out. So different local authorities spring up with ideas and write in, sending in their different bids, some from rather unlikely places. So for quite a long time, the one making the running in the northwest was Blackpool. We're going to have the University of Blackpool. That attracted quite a lot of comment, because Blackpool was a slightly challenging place, and so people had different views on this. And the best bit of that is someone who cheerfully wrote into the UGC saying, he says, I beg to strongly oppose the current suggestion that a university for the northwest of England should be established at or on the outskirts of Blackpool. A university is supposed to be a place where young people absorb culture and learning, not spivvery and paganism. And he goes on to say that he can't imagine a worse place to put a university apart from Soho. Now, it turns out that Lancashire starts to move more in the direction of Lancaster itself. They acquire some land at Belrigg, and Lancaster gets a nod over Blackpool. But we go through these independent writing-in exercises. So there's a businessman who's driving past Stamford in Lincolnshire, and he hears that the people at Stamford might be quite interested in having a university. They're one of the places that had a university suppressed in the Middle Ages, and he gets really involved in this, and he effectively becomes the leading light of this constant bid to have a university for Stamford. And they get quite a long way down the thinking. One of the key reasons is that Stamford's got a new bypass, so it's got plenty of land, it's been redeveloped, and it can think about having a university. And there's a whole published report on why it would be a good thing for the University of Stamford to get going. And these keep going through. So there's a bid for a university at Glastonbury. This nice chap writes in and says it'd be great to build a new university city of Avalon next to Glastonbury, and create a new university city. Now, he doesn't get anyone else supporting him, but there on the UGC file is his nice letter and the very polite letter back from the civil servants of the UGC saying, well, that's very interesting. Do follow up with some more details. So you go through these kind of stages, and there is a long list of places that at some point are considered to have a new university. Some of whom, that's fine, they go and get their university. So we have bids from Bournemouth and Carlisle and Chatham and Chester, and there's one from Coventry, which is obviously quite successful, but Plymouth and Salisbury and Stamford and Stevenage and Thanet. Thanet is one of the ones that makes one of the early running again, but in the end is passed over in terms of Canterbury. So you get this kind of wonderful pickup of these things. And the files are just great as you go through them, and you get this different information sent in by these people trying to say, well, can we have a university, please? So the best correspondence I found on the file is from the Swindon people. So the Swindon people start by this very apologetic letter from the town clerk saying, people in Swindon have asked me to write. I'm not sure personally about doing this, but what's the process? And then he kind of gets more into it, and the Swindon say, well, one of the things we want to do is deal with the fact that there's a perception that we're quite a dreary town and a university might be quite good for us. So they kind of talk about how this might go through. And his correspondence backwards and forwards goes on and on over about 4 years, because they don't quite get going in time. And slowly, it's clear that other people are getting their universities, but they're not. So by the end, when it's quite clear that there aren't going to be any more universities, this is sad little letter in from the town clerk to the UGC. Please do not groan too deeply when you receive this letter. I'm not going to harass you. I know that nothing can be done until the government announcement has been made about new universities. And he goes on to say, well, perhaps we could use a new bit of land. It might be a better bet for our new Swindon University. And he ends it in a sad little sign-off. Now, please don't toss this into the waste paper basket. Now, the good news is that it was all dutifully considered by the UGC. It's still lovingly kept on the file. Swindon did not get to have its university. The cut-off had come, and the government had changed its mind on how many universities it wanted. Because at that point, the new Labour government decides, that's it, no more universities, we're going to stop approving them, we've got enough students into the planning period, and we'll have no more.
Now, young people hate democracy because they can't afford their rent or something. Two new reports this week on big generational shifts. Paul, tell us more.
So they're two separate reports. I think they're probably, kind of pushes in slightly different directions. So there's a report from Loughborough that more people in their 20s and 30s are living at home for kind of fairly predictable reasons, unstable job market, high rents, and then related personal issues. So, you know, living at home with their parents for longer. And, you know, clearly, if you do that by choice, that's one thing. But if you do that because of a lack of other choices, then there's a real issue there. The other report comes from Cambridge, and it's kind of worth reading in that it's to launch a new centre on the future for democracy. So in launching a centre, you want a big headline. And, you know, they've got a big headline in terms of young people being disillusioned with democracy more than, you know, they have been over, you know, the past 20, 30 years. And there's kind of a few things I'd say about that. First of all, it's important to be clear that all of the data they're drawing on is pre-pandemic data, so we shouldn't read a kind of pandemic factor into this. The other thing is that, you know, what they were asked about was how is democracy working in your country? So this isn't necessarily a philosophical rejection of democracy as a concept. It's a dissatisfaction with the way in which democracy is working in their countries, you know, and over half of young people in the UK feeling like that. And in a way, I think this is possibly hopeful because they should be dissatisfied. You know, you look at the response to the climate emergency we're facing, you know, democracy is not responding to that well. And if you, you know, look at, you know, I was reading recently Peter Gagan's book, Democracy for Sale, and the influence of dark money on the democratic process in the UK is deeply concerning. So, to be honest, I'd be more worried if, you know, a high proportion of young people were satisfied with the way democracy is working, because we have clear issues about the way in which certain interests are controlling the political agenda and controlling it in a way that is not allowing us to respond to an existential crisis that we face.
And just, is the dissatisfaction about the sort of, you know, the way in which democracy delivers for young people's personal interests, or is it more about these kind of bigger macro issues, or both? I mean, what's the sense that comes through?
It's kind of hard to say because it's drawing from 25 different projects across 154 countries. And because of that, it's kind of, you know, at quite a high level of abstraction. And the questions they're asked are about how satisfied are you with the way democracy is working. So it's difficult to tease out the reasons. But, you know, so I've given you my version, but clearly, you know, there will be other reasons.
Marion, the Boomerang Report creates this sense that, you know, that there's a kind of extended early adulthood, you know, I was reading it thinking this is another one of those reports that sort of says you're not going to own a house or, you know, start a family or whatever till you're 30. You know, it's this thing about the 20s, isn't it? What is life like in people's 20s? And, you know, I guess that old model that said we graduated people into the kind of real world and, you know, they would very quickly, you know, obtain all these life markers. That's gone, hasn't it?
Gosh, that's a big question. But I think that's been gone for a long time now. Certainly from, you know, conversations with the younger people I've been having the past year. I mean, your 20s has always been pretty much the time when you couldn't afford anything. Let's be honest, I don't think it's ever been very different. However, I think anyone who's been around, you know, the past 10 years at least, will know that, you know, housing in particular is in crisis. You know, graduating university and buying a house is just not a thing, unless you are very lucky indeed. The country has been in not a very good financial state for quite some time. In fact, the world has been. It isn't a UK specific phenomenon. I would be very surprised if it was. But it is very interesting to see these things sort of against each other, the political disillusionment, if you will, against the opportunities that young people have had. Because, you know, we're talking about millennials, we are talking about people who are nearly 40 years old now. So it is something that's been going on for some time. It isn't something that's happening now. But Just to add to what Paul was saying, I think it does go a little bit beyond. So certainly in this country, just the number of elections we've had the past few years and how polarized the country has been. And, you know, the number of demonstrations we've had, the number, you know, I think it has been very hard to change anything. And I think this is partly where this disillusionment in democracy comes from, that voting doesn't change anything. And the only times we actually see anything changing is what's happening in the US now with Black Lives Matter, which is a really sad place to be, that we need to get to that point to actually see something changing for the better.
Wow, blimey, this is all very upsetting, isn't it? Paul, look, if I'm going to spend most of my 20s at my mum and dad's house, why am I being shoveled into university at the age of 18? Why can't I do it when I'm 25 or 26? Why does the conveyor belt, you know, push me straight in?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. You know, that kind of what David Watson kind of popularized as the royal road to education. You know, it's a really good question. You know, it would be far better to have a far more flexible kind of system in which people can come and go at different moments. You know, the biggest barrier to that is the kind of limitations that currently kind of look like they're being flexed a bit more about whether you can get funding to do the same level of qualification more than once. I think it's a really good question, and it might be that those kind of shifts in where people live and how they live kind of lead to changes in education. But we're kind of again caught in this tension that at one level, you know, there's right and genuine concern about how people can choose to live away from their parents, but there's also kind of also, you know, this sense of investing in a house about what the access to that resource gives you later in life, and, you know, allowing you to pay for your care when you're infirm. So, you know, there's a real tension here, because that whole sense of it being an investment is directly linked to the fact that, you know, so many people can't afford it. So we can't have both. We need to actually kind of decide where to go with it.
Let me ask both of you. So, you know, one of the things in that democracy report is this idea that, you know, democracy should, on some level, function to serve the population's interests, right? So if the if everywhere in the world that we've got an aging population, and that means the electorate is getting older, Is it realistically possible to serve the entire electorate, both socially and economically? Or are we doomed again to a kind of future where, you know, either major political parties pick a generation, or, you know, people under 30 are kind of vaguely abandoned? I mean, where will it go? Where will it go next? If as I say, you know, the balance of electoral power is with, you know, people that are in their 50s and 60s.
Well, I'm not sure it is, Jim. You know, if you read Democracy for Sale, you know, it's not people in their 50s and 60s who are shaping policy. It's unaccountable money coming in and pushing politicians in certain directions with certain agendas. And, you know, we can see this in the way that the pandemic has been responded to in this country, that the way in which, you know, track and trace has been kind of almost ideologically given to, you know, to private companies who are making a profit rather than looking locally. You know, I think it would be less depressing if a generation had been picked, but actually, you know, it's being shaped by forces, you know, actually, you know, beyond the country rather than by particular, you know, demographic sections of the population.
Good. Now, yes, it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? Here with this week's correlation question is Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan.
Welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? The podcast segment they couldn't lock down. I was thinking about international students this week, and the question is simple. Are providers with more full-time undergraduate international students also those that make the most money from full-time undergraduate international fees? Do more students always mean more money in this most price-sensitive area of the UK higher education marketplace? Does it correlate?
I'll say possibly a weak correlation, because subject mix is going to be key as well as number. So, you know, for example, having a management school is going to, you know, increase your income. But I'd still expect it to be a weak correlation.
Yes, it does. R-squared is 0.91, a very strong correlation. Despite the variation in international undergraduate fee levels, the relationship is clear. Volume is most important. I've also worked out the average fee income for this group of students for each provider, and the highest is Heriot Watt University at just over £52,000. The University of the West of Scotland sits at the other end, apparently making just £2,600 per full-time undergraduate international student. Data is from the HESA student and finance releases for 2018-19, and where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
Now, finally, universities and their students' unions in Wales are going to receive an additional funding package worth 10 million quid. Marion, what are they going to spend it on?
This is the most excellent news, that this money is going to be spent on mental health, food packages and digital enablement during the pandemic. This is money that comes on top of the previous 27 million that the Welsh Government gave universities during the summer. And it appears to come with no strings attached, which is indeed very refreshing and very positive to see.
Paul, it's 10 million doesn't sound like a lot, does it? But given there are, you know, 15 times as many students in England, this would be 150 million if it was in England. Yeah, it's quite a lot of money, really, given it's halfway through the academic year and it's got to be spent by the end of the academic year.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it's really welcome news. It's really good. And you know, the challenge is working out what to spend it on effectively within the time you've got to spend it. That, you know, that's often the challenge with these things, is the time it takes from finding out about the money to work out an effective strategy can sometimes take a while, and when the time is short, that can sometimes be challenging. But it's but symbolically, it's incredibly important. You know, given the kind of situation students are facing and the challenges they're facing, you know, things like this are incredibly important.
Paul, more broadly, why is it that we've sort of ended up in this strange position where universities are seen as the state for almost every aspect of student life? You know, it's universities that must fix X, it's universities that must support Y. Have we ended up there by accident? Is that deliberate? And is it wise, I guess?
Well, it's historical. The story that Lewis Elton, kind of one of the first professors of higher education in the UK, used to tell, was it goes back to the days of Oxford, where there was a student practicing archery in the street and killed a local person, and there was a big debate about whether the student should be dealt with by the university or by the local police. And the decision made was that the university was responsible for disciplining the students. And Lewis Elton argued that's why in the UK we have this model in which students are dealt with by their institutions for kind of clear crimes such as that, but also in terms of welfare. So it's not, you know, sometimes it can be kind of tied up with a kind of new infantilization of young people. But actually, you know, it goes back to, you know, the very early days of universities, you know, in England.
Good, well, that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show on Apple Podcasts or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you'll find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Paul, Marion, everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.